Hey, today we're talking about adult children of alcoholics, what that means as an adult growing up in a home with an active or only, I don't know, slightly recovered alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. We're going to learn that there's lots of different versions of what an adult child of an alcoholic looks like. Mm-hmm. You're going to be really surprised, and some of you are going to realize that you are an adult child of an alcoholic without you never knew, and it's going to really help make a lot of things from your childhood make sense.
Yeah. And then we're also talking about what to do about it, like how to heal, what are next steps. If you see yourself or hear yourself in part of our stories or discussion, we hope that that leads to you finding some ways to heal or learn more about what we're discussing. I recently wrote on my blog about adult children of alcoholics, and so many people were like, I didn't know there was a term for what I was feeling.
Yeah.
And so I hope that we have come from our knowledge standpoint in a way that helps people or encourages them to ask more questions.
Mm-hmm. It's not a topic that's maybe broached as often as it should be. Actually, I know it's not, mm-hmm. but I know that I have learned since we started researching this topic that there are so many ways to start the healing process. Mm-hmm. And that there's a lot of avenues that you can take. Even we've talked about this, even based on your income, mm-hmm. what you're able to pay for. So as always, that information will be in show notes.
All right. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Not Terrible with your hosts, Jess Hooker and Mary Graham. Jess is a part-time vegan yogi. You can find her on her motorcycle, usually heading to therapy. Mary is a writer and Jesus follower. She loves camping almost as much as cheeseburgers. The Not Terrible podcast is two childhood friends who have been through the ringer, learned some tough lessons, and kept going. Jess and Mary share stories, advice, and lessons on each episode. They try to find humor in the chaos and learn from their mistakes in an attempt to feel less alone as they navigate life's journey.
What are we talking about this week?
Oh, we are talking about adult children of alcoholics. And we will be referencing two books through this episode.
One is Adult Children of Alcoholics by Janet Ringer something tit.
What?
I don't know. I'll link it in the show notes.
The Adult Children of Alcoholic Syndrome is the other one, A Step-by-Step Guide to Discovery and Recovery by Wayne Kritzberg.
So we've talked about these books a lot with each other and just had some really like heavy truths come out of just like the realization of how much being raised in an alcoholic home you still carry for the rest of your life if you're not paying attention, and how much things change perspective when you realize the home you grew up in and what it kind of looks like and how it shaped you. And so we just thought we would talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah. And like everything, I always feel like it helps to preface this with that we are not professionals.
Nope.
We are just passing along knowledge that we've gained.
Or are actively learning.
Or actively learning in our own experience. Yeah. And this is just a medium to share that. This is not in any way to help you diagnose or treat other people.
Yeah. Just a conversation. So background is I'm married to an alcoholic who grew up in an alcoholic household. And you?
I don't know what to say. I know that I'm 91 days, and it even still feels weird to say sober.
Mm-hmm.
But for the point of this podcast, I'm 91 days sober. I still struggle with identifying as an alcoholic.
Which is a very common...
I think it's a very common thing.
Trait.
Yep. I'm going to explore it more with my mental health care professional. And I also did grow up in a a home with an alcoholic. Because I learned in my book, actually, we'll transition and start here, that I don't like the stereotypical, the idea of what an alcoholic home looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. There's kind of four different types of adult children of alcohol, what the home dynamic was. How about I say it like
okay.
that? So there's type one, where active alcoholism is in in every generation. It is passed, like there is someone with a bloodline that is an alcoholic.
For a long time.
For a long, long time.
Okay.
Type two, the actively drinking member of the nuclear family has stopped drinking, which would be the case with my children.
Mm-hmm.
I would be the family member that started drinking and stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But also, number three, the active drinking member of the family has been removed for one generation. So if you have a grandparent, or they even say you can go back as far as a great-grandparent that mm-hmm. drank. And then type four is a non-drinker becomes an alcoholic. So I don't know if our family is set up in a type two and a type four situation. That's something that, like I said, I'll have to dive into with my own therapy mm-hmm. and in recovery. But those are the four, like how
like
it
situations
looks.
Situations.
The situations that the most common, obviously. Okay. I'm sure there's other situations, but those are the most common where you will find the effects of alcoholism in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think it kind of feels safe to say any abuse of alcohol in any relationship impacts so many other people. Like
right.
just a very basic understanding of mm-hmm. alcoholism or drinking too much is it damages people and relationships. Like we can start there. And so then where we go from that is, well, how does it damage me or my children or my relationships? And how, like we say all the time, our goal is like knowledge and conversations then that you take outside of this podcast. So how does this information help you to heal or do better in relationships you have? Like that would be something that we're asking ourselves and then hoping that you would take from this also.
Yeah. And I don't know if your book touches on this, but I think this is what made me realize, like I said, I'd never, my background is both of my parents have had issues with addiction and substance abuse. I don't know if either one of my parents ever identified as an alcoholic. And that's not my mind to decide. However, I know that there was drinking. I know that there is a struggle. But I'm not comfortable saying that either one of my parents are because I don't think it's mine to say.
Okay.
But I know from reading this book that our households were run like someone that's an alcoholic would run a house.
Mm-hmm.
I had the experience of growing up in a house where alcohol and substance abuse was very present. And then at a different time in my childhood, I grew up in a house where it was happening, but it never happened in my presence.
So like more in your face versus behind closed doors a little
right,
bit?
Right, mm-hmm. right, right. And an alcoholic is an alcoholic and an addict is an addict, and they run their house a very specific way, and it's usually kind of the same way that they're running their life. So they're, according to this book, there are four rules of an alcoholic family. And all of these rules overlap a little bit, but there's usually one big rule that each family lives by. Rigidity is one of the big ones. In terms of that there's more rigid rules of behavior are imposed on the non-alcoholic members of the family so that the alcoholic feels like they're in control.
Mm-hmm.
There's the rule of silence, which bans the talking of the behavior and the actions of not only the alcoholic, but how the family feels about the behavior. Nobody talks about anything.
So secrets.
Everything's a secret. There's the rule of denial, which is kind of the cornerstone of all alcoholic families, but there's some people that just live by it harder than others, just the not acknowledging at all anything. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you can hear how a lot of these overlap.
Yeah.
And then there's the rule of isolation. They cling emotionally to each other, but it's never intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're in this together, but it's
we're in this pain mess together.
Right.
Not anything good.
Yeah. And it's kind of like the isolation in terms of we all know, but nobody else outside of our house will understand, so we don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't share. Like, it's all... And it's all so codependent that it makes me sick. It's nuts. It's nuts. But I just... It's interesting. I feel like those... Like, the family dynamic and the rules in which you run the alcoholic household, like, that's a very base place to start if you're curious about...
Mm-hmm.
Am I carrying the effects of alcoholism
mm-hmm.
in my life? Maybe being an alcoholic or feeling the effects of alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's like what you said about they all kind of overlap. So mm-hmm. I can tell you from the household that my husband grew up in, there were three of those things. So there was denial,
mm-hmm.
the parent that should have been able to say this is not appropriate. Denied the reality she was living in.
Mm-hmm.
Secrecy. You didn't talk about what was going on at home. You knew through words and actions that you didn't tell your friends or your friends' family or your family
mm-hmm.
what was going on when you came home. And then isolation. Chris and I talk a lot about how isolated his childhood was. How his parents didn't have friends. They lived in a different state from the majority of at least the larger side of the family. So they could go to that state and keep secrets and be in denial and control the narrative about what people thought was going on at their house to keep the addict and the codependent enabler safe. So I think... If you see one of those behaviors from your childhood or in your household, there's probably another little tag along friend that goes with it because they're just so ingrained in each other.
Mm-hmm. You can't have one without the other three somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. In the household where alcohol wasn't present, there was rigidity. It was there were rules hard and fast. And there wasn't wiggle room, and there wasn't conversations about when you broke those rules. It was mm-hmm. more like, I'm disappointed, and then just ignored until it passed.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess silence, too. I really don't know. I don't know. I don't, and with me here at our house, when I was drinking the most, it was probably isolation. I would find a reason to hate different friend groups or it was isolation in a weird way.
But addicts are also very paranoid. So
you can figure out
how to hate people because mm-hmm. they're probably talking about you.
Oh, absolutely. And mm-hmm. that was the thing, is that I wasn't going to show up somewhere. And I don't know. Yeah, I would say, but I withdrew from in-laws. I mean, I made a hard and fast line of... Like, I'm drawing it. We're not engaging with them. We're not doing this. And just fed into any unhealth that was already there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, really played up their
faults.
Their faults.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I'm not at fault.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Yeah, and then, so that's the side of denial coming in, of just, mm-hmm. like, the absence of... reality in your situation, mm-hmm. and you kind of create your own what you think is truth when it's not, because you're just so clouded with all the other things that mm-hmm. addiction brings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't, and now that I think about it, and I realize how angry and distant I was from my own family when I was drunk, but I wasn't drinking at home, mm-hmm. you know, like I would just be drunk, or I would go in the garage and take a couple shots or whatever it was. And just the difference in the kids' reaction to me. Like, they were scared. Like, we don't know if she's going to start screaming. We don't know if she's going to throw something. We don't know if she's going to, you know, not directed at them, but, I mean, just it was like around. That, like, yeah.
Walking on eggshells.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how my childhood was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't. Like, the less noise you make, the more you're loved. Like, do things. Don't talk about things. Like, make this house go. Well, we don't need to talk about it. You're not going to get thanked. No praise. Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you received love and affection. Be quiet.
That is. So I have often told this story. I might have even told it on here before about my first experience going to Chris's mom's house to have dinner with the family. The mom and dad had already, his mom and dad had already, divorced by this time. So it was his mom, his brother, his sister, Chris, and me. And I grew up in dysfunction also, but not addiction. And even though there were tense moments at home, we were always loud. Like, mm-hmm. we were just loud. Mm-hmm. The Ritters are loud people.
Yep.
Good or bad, just yeah. loud. So I grew up around the table that someone was always talking about something. My dad would bring a newspaper to the table and, like, tell us about the news. We would talk about our day. My mom would ask, like, the annoying questions that you ask kids in middle school and high school. So I always, there was always conversation at our dinner table. I went over to Chris's mom's house for the first time for dinner, and we ate in dead silence. No one said anything. No one even acknowledged that anyone else was there. It was just like a really, it was the oddest experience. And so for years I told that story and just kind of laughed about it.
Just how opposite your families
yeah,
are.
Like, yeah, like we just grew up in really different families.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of understanding addiction and an addiction that consumes your family is, like you said, you didn't, if you didn't make noise or draw any attention to yourself, you were safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, dinner was a time to be quiet and also eat as fast as you could so that you could get away from the table. And we still struggle with that now with Chris. Like, it annoys the crap out of me that he is there to consume his food as fast as possible when, hey, why don't you ask your kids about their day? Or, like, we can sit at the end of dinner and we don't have to jump up and immediately go off and do something. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's an intimacy in eating and engaging
sharing
with
a meal,
people
yeah. mm-hmm.
that families of alcoholics and addicts don't experience because it's not safe.
Mm-hmm.
So for years I told that story and was just like kind of in a funny way.
Mm-hmm.
But now the reality is that's a product of growing up in an environment surrounded by an alcoholic and an enabler who would, instead of try to get a family to talk, encouraged everyone to be quiet. And he had been gone for years at this point and they still were in that pattern of do not talk during dinner.
Wow.
And so I'm the oldest daughter and I fix things. And I remember when my parents were not getting along, it was my job to fill in the silence. So I would tell funny stories or I would draw attention to myself, good or bad, just mm-hmm. like fill and try to hide the silence. So mm-hmm. then me coming into that situation where everything is quiet, like it took everything in my being not to take over mm-hmm. that conversation and start mm-hmm. bringing people in and interacting and telling mm-hmm. funny stories and entertaining people mm-hmm. because that's my response to silence.
Yeah, but that's also like here you are, you've played this role in your family dynamic at home your entire life, and then you've met somebody and you plug right in to mm-hmm. where you would benefit that family.
Yeah. We've always spent a lot of time in counseling on how much of Chris and I's childhood environments and dysfunction filled holes for each other.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other episode of just like mirroring what we needed in not healthy ways.
Yeah.
Or we filled in each other's needs, but not in healthy ways because we didn't understand what healthy looked like.
No, but it somehow it served whatever you grew up in.
Yes.
Like, I'm not saying that it did not contribute to your health, but it did serve you at that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was a fast eater. Like we did that. We didn't share a lot of family sit down meals growing up because my dad worked a lot. And, so it was kind of my job to get people fed and do it. So I would be the last one at the table and I would eat so fast because I knew everybody else would be done soon and I had to clean up and clear out and do that. So I still do that. I'm the last one to the table. I eat as fast as I can and I'll be done before everybody else is done.
Yeah.
And Max always laughs because I eat so fast.
But like that was like bred into you as a child then like stepping back to understand, well, here's why I behave this way and how is it benefiting me or hurting me now?
Right.
And then trying to like balance that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with serving other people, but if you do it at the expense that you're not enjoying a meal or engaging in conversation or getting help at all, and you're a servant as opposed to a member of the family, like that's a red flag.
Yeah. And I think that it contributes a lot to when I am home alone and I eat alone and I prepare a ridiculous amount of food. And then I eat it very slow and I enjoy it so much, but then I eat a lot and I like don't feel well. Yeah. And I just think that that's kind of
it's all connected.
Yeah. 'Cause if nobody's here while I'm eating a meal, then that means I get to enjoy the meal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. So my book on mine is the Adult Children of Alcoholics. That's literally the name of the title of the book and the episode and in this conversation. So it's got lots of layers. So I shared this on Instagram, I don't know, a while ago, and so many people were like shocked and overwhelmed and very intrigued when they realized the things that they're doing now as adults were actually on this list and that you could tell someone was an adult child of an alcoholic based on how they behaved. So I think we have for so long heard what an alcoholic looks like or what this is what alcoholics, especially like stereotyped versions of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And we have not yet gone the next level of like, here's what it does to the family or the children. So I'm going to read this list and then we can kind of go back and talk about what that looks like in our own experiences. So the back of the book says, are you an adult child of an alcoholic? Adult children of alcoholics guess at what normal behavior is. Adult children of alcoholics have difficulty following a project through from beginning to end. Adult children of alcoholics lie when it would just be as easy to tell the truth. Adult children of alcoholics judge themselves without mercy. They have difficulty having fun. They take themselves very serious. They have difficulty with intimate relationships. Adult children of alcoholics overreact to changes over which they have no control. They constantly seek approval and affirmation. They usually feel that they are different from other people. They are either super responsible or super irresponsible. Adult children of alcoholics are extremely loyal, even in the face of evidence that the loyalty is undeserved. And adult children of alcoholics are impulsive. And now we'll do an episode on every one of those because it's so big and weighty and
there's, I mean, yeah, there's too just, real. It's, there's so much that is, that's a lot. It's just a lot. There's no other way to say it. And I feel like I identify with more of those than I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is like that too, in that, it talks about the I think that was a lot of mental and emotional, behavioral characteristics.
Yeah. Do you have physical?
So, yeah. So this also includes, that they also immense back pain, which I've suffered from, and we've talked about this too.
I told Chris about that after last week when we talked. Like, he has constant back pain.
And it's, it's...
Like, when he was 21 and there was nothing possibly wrong at all.
Could have ever.
He hasn't worked hard enough, long enough to have, like, back issues. And he was all, like, from a very young age, suffering from back pain like an old man.
I remember coming home from college because it was so bad that I came home like on a Thursday and I was like, I don't know how. I drove home and I was in bed for 3 days and my aunt just kept bringing me ice packs and I couldn't move for 3 days. And that was the first time that it was like, it was so much. And now as I'm saying that out loud, I'm thinking about what was going on in my family at that moment. And it makes so much sense. It's not something that I will ever share on this podcast at this. Well, not ever. Yeah. But I won't. It's just too much. But it makes a lot of sense.
And we've talked before about how, like, it's all connected. So, like, the body keeps the score. So you are... In so many ways, your brain is connected to your pain sensors. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked before about how alcoholics and addicts also have an exaggerated sense of pain. Yes. So like adult children of alcoholics mm-hmm. maybe have excessive back pain, but like mm-hmm. addicts don't understand their bodies have a hard time regulating correctly. So what is a normal pain to lots of people mm-hmm. feels like overwhelming pain to an alcoholic.
Especially to an alcoholic and an addict. And I was always the opposite because any physical ailments that we had growing up were non-existent. Unless you were bleeding out, I mean, they're
handle it.
Yeah, handle it and do not talk about it. If you're sick, you don't want to hear about it. And it was more of like a toughen up, which I'm grateful now because I have an amazing immune system. But it just was. And so now I see myself when I hear someone say that they're sick or they don't feel well, it immediately angers me. You baby, suck it up. I could care less. And they always have these memes about like moms that are nurses and how they, and I was like, maybe I was supposed to be a nurse because I do not deal well with people complaining. But outside of back pain, adult children of alcoholics will experience ulcers, allergic reactions, and sexual dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's funny because my book says something about, in her research, adult children of alcoholics do not have any other type of, so don't have any higher rates of sexual issues than any other group.
Oh, okay.
So that's interesting.
Huh. This one doesn't dive much into the very much the physical ailments of it. There were some other interesting things that they discussed, though. It talks about gastrointestinal disorder. That's another physical thing. Stress-related disorders, such as like cancer and other diseases mm-hmm. that they say are intensified by stress. There was a couple, which I think like ulcers, that's a part of it. The tense shoulders, the lower back, that's a big thing. And to go back to the mental characteristics, thinking in absolutes, which always and never, those are two words I've had to cut out of my vocabulary because it was.
You just stopped yourself a minute ago.
I know that that's not the case. Having a lack of information, a lot of, I don't know, I don't understand, you know. Compulsive thinking, indecisions, learning disabilities, confusion, and hypervigilance.
Mm.
Yeah. I know we talk a lot about the Enneagram, but when I read some of these things and it's just like, did this lifestyle set me up to be a two? And
that's it, like the Enneagram question of like, was I born this number or was I molded into this number? And that fits for my husband too, who is a nine and a peacemaker. He will at all costs try to keep things peaceful and calm and please you, but to the detriment of his own health.
Does yours talk anything about behavioral characteristics? Because mine does too. It has a really great chart of emotional, mental, physical, and behavioral. But the behavioral ones include crisis-oriented living, manipulative behavior, intimacy problems, and able to have fun. You talked about that, I think. Tries to fit in, and compulsive addictive disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is obvious. Very common.
So one of mine, when it talks about the intimacy, the difficulty with intimacy, it says the first and most obvious reason is that they have no frame of reference for a healthy relationship and a healthy intimate relationship because they never saw one. So the reality is if you're in a relationship, and I feel like this should be said to millions of women and men, if you are in a relationship with an addict or an alcoholic at any degree, your relationship cannot be healthy. Mm-hmm. There is no health. You can't say I have a good marriage and I'm married to an alcoholic. Like that, those are extreme opposites. So,
and you can't find the positive and say, oh, well, but he's a good dad she's an amazing breadwinner
she's
or
fun
whatever.
At parties.
They don't cancel each other out.
No. And he's not a good dad. If he's an alcoholic, he's not teaching the things that your children need to know to be healthy adults if he's an alcoholic.
Yeah, and he's not showing up. If he's taking time, if he's doing that, spending his time, that's.
So another difficulty with adult children of alcoholics and with the intimate relationships is, and we talked about this last week when we were going to record about this, but we've just been struggling so much with actually hitting record. Adult children of alcoholics carry with them the experience of come close and go away, the inconsistency of a loving parent-child relationship. So you learn extremes from parenting from your parents who are codependent, enabling, or alcoholics, where they tell you in a happy moment that they love you, and in the next moment, get away from me. So there is this constant confusion, because if you love me, you would want to be near me, but please get away from me. No, I do love you. Leave me alone. And not like in a joking way of like when I tell my kids, like, go outside and play. Mm-hmm. Like, I love you, but leave me alone. But like the cycle of addiction of extremes.
Yeah. And I think that goes into, and from my experience, that kind of lifestyle of, yes, I love you, but get away from me, also makes you realize that actions aren't important. Well, he says it, so he must mean it, but he doesn't have to show it. So I'm going to seek out a mate who really doesn't show me that they love me. They say it, so that's enough, and I'm going to believe them.
Right. Actions and words don't match up, so it confuses a child. And then when we grow up, we don't see that when actions and words don't match up, that it's a red flag, because that's what someone who I think loved me did that. So you can probably love me and not do what you're going to say, not say what you're going to do.
I'm going to touch. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk about the physical and the emotional abandonment that comes with living in a house with an alcoholic. Do you have anything you want to touch on in the second part?
No. I got some abandonment stuff to talk about. That.
Good. Let's touch on that when we come back right after this.
Before we get back into the episode of Adult Children of Alcoholics, I wanted to share real quick that I am hosting another workshop in October. It is October 5th. If you are local to Indianapolis and you want to work on your writing skills, want to become a better writer, at work, at home, on the internet, social media, wherever you wish you could write, or just in a journal at home. I would love for you to come to the workshop. You can get access to the event if you go to the show notes, grab a ticket. It is Saturday from 9 to 1, Jess will be there.
I will be there. I am. I'm going to be the hostess with the mostest. Mm-hmm. Mary's going to be the teacher with the
Peter. I didn't know what to rhyme.
I don't know, but
that's
I don't think Peter's right.
That's
no. And this will be my second writing workshop with Mary, and I'm actually looking forward to it. I've got my notes from the last workshop, and I'm taking them, and I'm going to revise them and add more stuff. So it'll be fun. So maybe even if you've taken it already and you want to take it again, it's just a fun hangout.
Yeah, it is. So if you would like to join us on Saturday for Becoming a Writer with Mary Graham, visit the show notes. And if you cannot make it or you're not local, there is an online version where you can have the course sent to you via email. So if you are not good in person and you'd rather learn from the comfy couch at your house, I have an online version for the course too. So hope to see you there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. All right, we're back. This is second half of Adult Children of Alcoholics, the podcast episode on Not Terrible, where we are using our two books, The Adult Children of Alcoholics Syndrome and Adult Children of Alcoholics. Two different books, period. Two different authors. Mm-hmm. But yes, so we're kind of using these as guides for this episode.
So when we left off, we had just kind of wrapped up talking about adult children of alcoholics have difficulty with intimate relationships and that dynamic of come close, go away, that inconsistent love and rejection. And that leads to children feeling a sense of fear for abandonment. Mm-hmm.
It's a very primal feeling,
yes,
actually.
Yes. So it says if it isn't overwhelming, it gets in the way, not knowing what it's like to have a consistent day-to-day healthy intimate relationship with a parent makes building one later on in life very painful and complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a child when abandoned experiences a very primal fear, and the primal fear is that if I don't have an adult with me, I'm going to die. Like, they have to care for me. I can't care for myself. If you put a toddler in charge of itself, it will die. It can't take care of itself.
Yeah.
So I think that in terms of abandonment, there's a physical abandonment and there's an emotional abandonment. And the physical covers missed meals, which I know that sounds silly, but there's a lot of, like, that just kind of doesn't cross your mind, I guess, when you're drinking or you're not, I mean, those basic needs of, like, food.
Right. A lot of addiction, I mean, addiction is an extreme form of self-centeredness. Mm-hmm. And so you don't often think about how it's affecting or how to care for others correctly. And I know that my husband and his siblings often had to be in charge of their own meals when they shouldn't have had to be.
Yeah, yeah. Feeding yourself, leaving children unclean, helping them maintain their own. I mean, not their own. I mean, there comes a time when they can. But even kids, as they grow up, need to be reminded or encouraged. Hey, right. You have to take a shower.
Yeah. Yeah. Like basic mm-hmm. grooming.
Right.
Things.
Yeah. Yeah. Those types of things. Children that are left alone for hours and sometimes days. And I think this happens way more often than we do realize. Actually, we do realize it's just acceptable, but older brothers and sisters caring for younger siblings.
Right.
Which is my life story. Personal experience. Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The emotional abandonment, the physical needs are met, but there's no nurturing, there's no hugging, and there's no emotional intimacy. None of that is going on. And when you are emotionally abandoned as a child, you begin to develop a deep sense of worthlessness.
Yes, that is a huge...
you are in the way and you are not wanted.
Yes. Yeah. fear of abandonment leads you to not feel confident about yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't feel good about yourself or believe that you are lovable. So you look to others for what is, for what you cannot give yourself in order to feel okay. And so that kind of breeds the codependency mm-hmm. aspect
yeah.
that you have been told that you're not worth anything. And you rely solely on it, especially when you're growing and developing, you don't, you develop self-worth based on the people around you. Mm-hmm. And if the people around you don't have any self-worth and don't give you any value, you don't understand how that,
right.
You don't have a frame of reference.
Right. And it kind of makes the physical and the emotional abuse kind of, for me, go hand in hand in my experience in that, the physical abandonment of taking care of siblings and then not being nurtured or hugged or any emotional intimacy made me go, oh, well, this physical abandonment aspect, this is how I know my worth because I'm caring for my siblings mm-hmm. because I don't know my worth because there were never any intimate connections or deep conversations or anybody interested in knowing who I am. My worth was solely based on what I was willing to provide and do for this family.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to the abandonment engulfment phenomenon. Engulfment is when the parent feels guilty for abandoning and neglecting the child and tries to make it up by smothering the child with attention and gifts. Which is something that I experienced in growing up at times.
Yeah. And it seems so common sense now, but I had a friend at one time that I knew her dad was an alcoholic, and it never crossed my mind that it would show up in our relationship or some of the things she was doing were based on that, relationship growing up. I just feel like in so many ways, like you don't know what you don't know. And then when you learn something, it shifts everything. And like the past mm-hmm. 5 years of my life have been so many shifts, and I see people and behavior and hurts differently when you get more information mm-hmm. and it's making me more tender and compassionate, but it also connects some things that mm-hmm. didn't always make sense. But I, from experience, have seen that cycle of I can't love you in a way that's healthy or in an intimate way because I'm an alcoholic. I will give you things to fill those holes. And now this person is living as an adult and it has just magnified itself times 20. Like she can't. Yeah. It's just like heartbreaking to think about.
It's, I grew up in that situation of come close, no, go away. And my entire relationship with my ex-husband is based on that. I mean, if you could simplify it down to one cyclical happening, it's come close, get away, come close, get away, mm-hmm. come close, get away. And as soon as we felt like, we felt exposed or vulnerable, it was like, nope, too close, too close, too close. You can't see this. This is a mess. And I've got to keep pretending that I'm better than you so you can't get too close.
So like any hard or what felt like a unsafe conversation meant followed up by days of silence.
Days. Which is the same thing that happened in my house.
Yeah. So the book I have, my husband also read. He read it before me. Just so as I'm reading through it, I'm seeing some of the marks that he made.
Right.
And when we get to this chapter on abandonment and what that feels like, just some of the things that he has highlighted or made a note on mm-hmm. just kind of break my heart. And they all... So the book that I have, a lot of them have experiences from other adult children of alcoholics because she's just done a lot of research and therapy. And then she's asked for permission to use some of their like right. responses. And a lady, Nancy, says, I have a really strong I have a really strong panic reaction to someone's anger with me. The panic that I experience is so extreme that I really don't know what to do with it, so that whenever there's a small amount, the fear is so great that it always escalates, and I guess I would love to know how people handle rejection, because to me, it becomes more of an issue of abandonment. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, who often has strong reactions to lots of things, like it's just my personality to have a loud or quick opinion about something, to realize now, 13 years into our marriage, that has always been read by Chris as, is she going to abandon me because of this? Mm-hmm. I mean, that just hurts. Like, that I love my anger is never actually anger, just like anyone else's. It's something else underneath it. But my first response to many things is anger. And it's not an anger that lasts forever. It's an anger for this 5-minute conversation. And then we go on with our lives and I'm fine because we resolve that.
Mm-hmm. It's very isolated.
Yes. Yeah. Like, it is not. And it also, yeah, like I don't carry it with me later, mm-hmm. which I don't know. That's just how it works. So knowing that if I ever had a tough conversation or something made me mad, or I disagreed with my husband about something and then we moved on, He didn't move on. And mm-hmm. he worried that it meant this was a deal breaker for him. Mm-hmm. For me. It was a deal breaker for me.
Yeah. What was an isolated incident for you? You just pulled up 35 years worth of damage. Yeah.
And also, one of the things that kind of shifted a lot of my thinking is that when an adult child of an alcoholic feels like someone is getting angry with them, it immediately makes them like remember that fear of abandonment, and that takes precedent to whatever the real issue is. Mm-hmm. So the real issue never gets dealt with because the adult is trying to handle the fear of being left. And so the real issues don't get handled and they just keep stacking up and piling up.
Right. And so whatever reaction they adopted that was for their survival as a child, usually fight or flight, mm-hmm. is what happens.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring that up. There's an abandonment matrix in my book, and we've all talked about the iceberg of like what shows compared to what's actually going on, and mm-hmm. this is a lot like that. So when you have resentment, distrust, loneliness, and sadness, just under the surface of that is anger and hurt, which are two very real emotions. But then the base of those things are fear, and then the fear is fear of abandonment. So abandonment really is the root emotion when you come from a family of alcoholism.
And a lot of it, and you brought this up earlier about like the they live in a constant state of stress or trauma, something like that.
Yeah, I think we talked about that last week too.
Of just like there is, when you live in a home with an alcoholic and you come home every day, you don't know what you're going to find. Mm-hmm. So it could be one extreme or the other, or it could be somewhere in the middle, and you are on high alert all the time, and that literally alters your cells. Like, it mm-hmm. alters your being when you live at a constant state of stress all the time.
Yeah, this actually refers to it as chronic shock. Mm. And the story that it tells, which I don't know if I told this on the episode we talked about, but it talks about a little boy and he's coloring in his bedroom and he hears a fight break out, which is not uncommon downstairs. And he just sits there and he listens. He doesn't color. He doesn't do anything. He just sits there and he listens to the progression, the intensity, and everything that happens in an argument. Then he hears his mother scream very loud, and then he hears a gunshot. And he sits there. And he sits there and he sits there and he sits there and he doesn't know what to do, because he doesn't know what he's going to find. So eventually he has the courage to go downstairs, and his mother's sitting on the couch holding her face and crying, and his dad's sitting in front of the television with a drink. And his mother says, "Your father shot out the television. Go to bed." And the father just fired the gun at the television, and the screen exploded, and he was sitting there staring at a broken television. And he was relieved. But that he sat, that, but this is a common thing. One of these times, you know, and what happens, there's you're basically like your baseline, and then you're in the shock stage of like, oh crap, what happened? What am I going to uncover?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in the rebound stage of, or the relief that nothing absolutely terrible happened.
Something bad happened, but not as bad as you thought.
Not as bad as mm-hmm. you thought. And then you begin to rebound from it. And then you find resolution. And the resolution is often one of those four things we talked about earlier, which is the silence or the denial or the isolation. Like this, we are not going to talk, probably more than anything, the silence.
We just don't talk about
it. We're just not going to talk about it. Yeah. Pretend that it didn't happen. And so in those situations, you live in... And they call it chronic shock.
And then you just start again.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, that will alter you as a human being.
Yeah. And also the patterns you learn then in childhood are the ones that you repeat in adulthood. So that's why it's so common for for kids that grew up in alcoholic homes to continue what they, like we teach our mm-hmm. kids in our homes how to live as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live with an alcoholic, the lessons you're getting are teaching you how to live as an alcoholic later.
Mm-hmm.
And I have lots of conversations with people about addiction and alcoholics, and the pushback and the people that believe they're special
mm-hmm.
and that their kids won't do this.
Right.
It doesn't matter that like
mm-hmm.
that my husband grew up in a household with an alcoholic, he can drink and I'll teach my kids how to do it differently. Like that, the reality is that's not how it works.
No, because you're still getting to one of those bases. If you think you're teaching your child how to deal with your spouse's alcoholism, all you're doing is teaching them a different way to be silent, a different way to deny. I mean, it's still, all of the root issues are still there.
Or you're teaching them how to find their own alcoholic when they get older
right.
and how to support that alcoholic.
Yeah. To be an enabler, exactly. Yeah.
Like there is, so there is no special, like magical way to live with an addict or an alcoholic and say that your kids will be different. Like it's just not. It's just not how it works.
And we keep saying alcohol and addict, but in these books, they're very clear that if you can live in a family of just dysfunction.
Yeah. So it says on the back of mine, the legacy of growing up in an alcoholic home or any type of dysfunctional environment can follow us into adult life with negative consequences on health, work, and love.
Yeah. And I think it's important to even, like, people that were, that experienced, like maybe even an isolated traumatic event, witness something horrible or, I mean, it could be a one-time event that changed their lives forever. And in that dysfunction of not dealing with what happened to them, you still carry that on to your children.
Mm-hmm. I think the last thing I would want to talk about is, adult children of alcoholics, which a lot of times in writing you just see ACOA.
Yeah.
But I stumble on it every time I say that loud, so I'm just saying it out loud. So adult children of alcoholics are impulsive. They tend to lock themselves into a course of action without giving serious consideration to alternative behaviors or possible consequences. This impulsivity leads to confusion, self-loathing, and loss of control over their environment. In addition, they spend an excessive amount of energy cleaning up the mess. And the problem with that is they don't learn from the mess. They go back and do the exact same thing again and then just work really hard to clean it up. Jess and I have joked a lot about how often we've come into this space to record a podcast and then just talked. and basically did our own friend podcast that we didn't hit record on.
Yeah.
I mean, like 4 or 5 hours at a time. I don't know what's happening. I don't know. But one of the things that Jess said to me when we were not recording one day was, do you, and I'm paraphrasing, she asked me if I felt it was important to start sharing some of the current struggles my marriage is having, specifically with impulse control for my husband. And that maybe I don't always give the full picture of the kind of just the way things are right now, almost in a way that protects him a little bit. And I've thought about that question a lot. And just like trying to weigh what's important to share publicly versus, you know, what's still just not important for the internet to know about. And in a very general way, I would say of all the list of issues with addicts or adult children of alcoholics that we are still struggling with is impulsivity. I'm married to someone who was not taught the life skill of thinking about doing something and weighing the pros and cons and long-term effects of it before doing it. And a lot of that has to do just with maturity. And we, hopefully, as adults, as we age, we also mature, and that comes with experience and lessons and learning. But for a lot of addicts and adult children of alcoholics, they have never been taught how to think through an action before just doing it.
Yeah, the concept of cause and effect.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Doesn't exist.
No, it does not. And the my book says the impulsivity is a very childlike quality. Ordinary children are impulsive, but when you were a child, you were more of a parent than a child. So this is talking to the adult children of alcoholics. So your present impulsive behavior is something you missed during your childhood. If you missed out on the stage, quite often you make it up at another time in your life. When a child has a parent who functions as a parent and a child acts out impulsively, they say, you can't do this because this is what will happen and here's the consequence. But children of alcoholics, they do not know how to predict the outcome of any behavior because they don't know how to do it. So as I'm at dinner with my girls and we're talking about something and Ellie wants to do this, I'm like, okay, well, what would happen? You know, like if you do that, what would happen tomorrow at school? Right. So if you skipped your homework tonight, what would be the consequence tomorrow at school? Well, I'd have to clip down or I'd have to pull my card and then my grades would suffer. And then you would see the note in my agenda and then I would get in trouble at home. So like we talk through as a normal parent-child relationship, you are teaching your children how to think through things by asking questions and modeling what that is. But adult children of alcoholics, they don't have that framework. No one ever did that for them. Mostly because their parents probably don't have that either, and you can't teach something you don't know. So children of alcoholics, when they think, when I behaved impulsively in the past, this happened and this happened, this person reacted this way. So they think about how someone got mad at them when something happened, not like full responsibility for something.
Yeah.
So that's just I got a little teary-eyed telling that part. I just, in lots of ways, I wish I would have known what marrying an adult child of an alcoholic was before I got married. And I also wish I would have understood like the way lack of impulse control would continue to just mess things up for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sober or not.
Yeah. It's still something that you have to learn, and he's just now starting to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, as a child, you have a good 17, 18, 20 years before you are really in charge of all of your consequences. You know, like there's always a parent to manage some of that for you. So I'm asking my husband to learn something that he didn't learn the first 35 years of his life, and it's not going as quickly as I would like, and that's really, really frustrating.
Yeah. And I feel like I asked if you wanted to share that because I felt like I wanted you to defend yourself, because so often you either share on social media or you write a blog post and it has to do with how addiction and alcoholism has affected your life. And when you write about it, sometimes you write about it in a very general way. And I know a lot of people are like, God, Mary, let it go. He's been sober for 2 years. Well, usually when you write about it again, it's because another event that usually has all to do with impulse control has come up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and sometimes it is months in the making. And I just was like, Mary, you've got, like, I know it doesn't sound like it, but this is a way for her to talk through what's going on in her life and still, on some level, protect her husband's integrity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know a lot of people, when they hear me talk about our story or my husband's story, they think I'm being mean. Mm-hmm. But if I gave you the whole story, you would know how much I'm protecting and loving right. him and what I'm sharing.
Yeah. 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 My book closes with how to start the recovery process. So I'm just going to mm-hmm. share these bullets real quick. Okay. You know, there's always individual therapy, which we advocate for almost on every episode. There's group therapy. There's family therapy. There's treatment programs specifically for adult children of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And there is adult children of alcoholics. It's called Al-Anon.
Yeah, that's for adult children. That's for spouses of alcoholics. That's okay. for anyone that loves someone.
Who's an alcoholic.
Who's an alcoholic. Yep. But Al-Anon. That's a good place. Yeah. Yeah. I like, so my book is set up a little bit different, but it's, I tell everyone to read this book. If you're on social media and you tell me at any time you're married to or you grew up in an alcoholic household, I tell you to read this book. And one of the reasons I like it so much is the first part is about what happened to you as a child. And it kind of just in general, here's what your house probably looked like. And most adults are just like, oh, I thought that was just my house. Oh, it's very common. Cool. And then it talks about what's happening to you now. So that's where we kind of go through like adult children of alcoholics lie even when they shouldn't. Or when it's easier to tell the truth, like their impulse yeah. is just to lie. And then it gives you about a section about breaking the cycle, how you start to heal and the things you need to start working on and practicing and learning. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about what about your children? Mm-hmm. So it gives you like three, like here's the household you grew up in. Here's what you can do right now in your house. Mm-hmm. And here's what you can do to make sure your children's houses later do not carry these into them. And then recovery hints, and it gives you some other recommended reading. I would love
yeah.
for people to get the books that we have read.
I would too. This is, and even if you don't know like treatment options, where to start, my book has like kind of a little mini like exercises, writing suggestions. Like maybe like if you're nervous to go out in the world and share this, mm-hmm. maybe start with this book, The Adult Children of Alcoholic Syndrome. And it has 5 or 6 chapters of maybe working through and helping you to understand a little bit better what your family dynamic was and how it is affecting you now before you decide to explore other treatment options.
And I think that's helpful because a lot of times I hear people can't get help because they don't have the money mm-hmm. to get the things that they think they need, or they don't have the time to go to meetings or things that they feel most people do. So start with the book and start with the very easy kind of like workbook part of it.
I know this was a heavy topic. There's a lot to digest, and like so many of our topics, the more we learn, the more we share. So I'm sure there will be another episode about ACOAs. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Not Terrible with Jess Hooker and Mary Graham.
Connect with the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Not Terrible Podcast. Visit them at notterriblepodcast.com for show notes and additional content. You can sign up for their newsletter to receive bonus episodes and podcast extras. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast provider. Not Terrible is recorded in conjunction with The Chick McGee Show and Off the Air Podcast. Recorded in the Front Room Studio, this has been a Waco production.